The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org.
So, first, I welcome you to the new year. And it's my custom for the first talk of Monday nights in the new year to give a talk on the Four Noble Truths. It's said that when the Buddha was awakened to the Four Noble Truths. And then when he first started teaching, he taught the Four Noble Truths. And in the classic description of this, it talks about that with the experience and teaching of the Four Noble Truths, there was light, there was vision, and there was knowledge. And that light and vision and knowledge is something the Buddha then offered to the world. And at least for Buddhists, that was considered to be a very momentous occasion, his first teaching that he gave. So the the Four Noble Truths are four rather simple statements. And the first statement is that there is the noble truth of suffering. The second noble truth is a noble truth of the arising of suffering. The third noble truth is a noble truth of the cessation of suffering. And the fourth is the noble truth of the path for the cessation of suffering. So we have this idea of suffering, the arising of it, the appearing of it, the ceasing of it, and a path for the full ceasing of suffering. And it's customary to, when we go into more detail of what this might mean or how it's understood, to begin with the first one and then go through 1, 2, 3, 4. And today I'd like to go the other direction. So the fourth is the noble truth of the way. And it's usually described as, or explained, as by the Eightfold Path. So the way to the cessation of suffering is the Noble Eightfold Path the Buddha taught. And in fact, when the Buddha first taught, he didn't begin by teaching the Four Noble Truths. He had a kind of introduction where he taught first the Noble Eightfold Path. And the story goes that for about 6-7 years, the Buddha was an ascetic. He was searching for the spiritual truth and liberation in the ways that were available to him in ancient India. And one of the ways was asceticism. If you starved yourself enough and suffered enough physically, and that you somehow would exhaust your bad karma and somehow be free. And so he tried that, and he had companions. He had 5 companions he did that with. At some point he decided this was not the way. The classic story is that he collapsed, and maybe into a river. He was so thin that he could put his hand on his belly and he could touch his spine. And how you saw him emaciated, and he would collapse, and people thought he was dead. And then he would kind of revive and stumble around. So at some point he said, you know, this doesn't make any sense. You know, no one's done asceticism as well as I have, and the only next step is to die completely, and that doesn't work. So this is not the path forward. And then he had a memory of a time when he was very young, we think maybe around 6-7 years old, where his father, who was kind of a local chieftain, was leading the spring plowing festival, so the first plowing of the spring in the fields. And the Buddha-to-be, who was a young boy, was left kind of unattended at the edges of the field under the shade of a tree. And some sitting there, contently and peacefully in this nice setting, he dropped into a very deep state of concentration that was very pleasant, very harmonious, unified, connected, delightful to be in, peaceful. At the end of his ascetic practice all these years, he remembered that occasion. And he thought to himself, maybe this is the way forward. I do not need to be afraid of this kind of pleasure. And the reason he said not to be afraid of this kind of pleasure, there was an idea in ancient India that part of the reason for asceticism, that any kind of pleasure was somehow defiled, polluted, somehow part of it, the world of attachment and clinging. And so you weren't supposed to have any pleasure if you were really on the path seriously. So you're left just to be an ascetic. So he said, maybe, asceticism doesn't work, and this pleasure I had as a young kid, it wasn't sensual pleasure like the way you normally think about it. It wasn't like you got wonderful food or wonderful sex or wonderful massage or wonderful music. It just sat there peacefully, and something shifted inside of him where he became unified, connected, whole, and felt very good. So maybe this is the way forward. And so he decided to eat food and to be able to sit, be fortified, to be able to sit and meditate in this way. At this point, his five companions, who were also ascetics, were thought that he had given up the true way, that he was now, he'd reverted back to the problems of sensual desires and overindulgence and those things. So they abandoned him. They left. And the Buddha was left alone, and then he proceeded to meditate the way he had as a young kid, and he found that this was actually a powerful way to go forward to practice. And in fact, you don't have to be afraid of this kind of pleasure, he said. And so he discovered a deep, concentrated meditation, and when his mind got very, very still, then he became liberated. After he was liberated, he wanted to share what he discovered with someone who would understand. And he finally settled on that his five companions, they would understand. So he went and found them. But when he arrived to see them, they saw him coming in the distance, and they said to each other, "Let's none of us stand up when he comes, when our old companion comes, because he's reverted to the kind of defiled life of sensual pleasures." And so they made this pact, right? They weren't going to stand or anything. But when the Buddha approached, he was so radiant and so peaceful, it's clearly been transformed in such a way that they couldn't help themselves but to stand up. And they made him a seat and brought him water and sat him down. And then they were willing to listen to him. So his companions were living in the old paradigm of that time, that there were two extremes, that there was extreme of sensual pleasure or the extreme of asceticism. Sensual pleasure was defiled, was impure, so the way to go was through asceticism. So when the Buddha sat down to talk to them, the first thing he said was, there is a middle way, there's a middle path between sensual indulgence and asceticism. So the Buddha didn't accept this hard dichotomy or duality that existed at that time. There's an alternative. He called it the middle way. And that middle way is the Noble Eightfold Path. Because what the Buddha had discovered was to live a life, live a way in the world, which was not asceticism, is not indulging in sensual pleasure. And he was going to describe to his friends, this is the life that I discovered. And he called it the Noble Eightfold Path. And it's eight different aspects of human life that come together as a unified whole. They're not necessarily sequential, but they all come together and support each other for how to live an enlightened life or a wise life or a complete whole life. And it begins with having a perspective. The right, usually it's called right view in English, but a right perspective, a certain way of seeing this world of ours. And essential or core to this way of seeing the Buddha had was to see in some kind of deep, moment-to-moment way that our world begins and ends repeatedly over and over again. It arises and passes, rises and passes. The year comes, a year goes. Day comes, a day goes. A breath comes, a breath goes. A thought comes, a thought goes. That there's constantly made up of this coming and going of phenomena that goes on. And it's hard for human beings to really appreciate the fine detail of this moment-to-moment rising and passing, because we're telling ourselves stories. Stories about our lives, stories about what's happening. We have concepts and ideas that kind of keep a semblance of things kind of being a little more stable than they are. We're kind of like, a little bit like magicians who are kind of conjuring up a projected virtual reality of our world. That's accurate enough because we usually don't bump into things. But it kind of overlays a sense of permanence on experience that's much more of a projection onto it than what's actually there. At least in our moment-to-moment experience of life, things are constantly shifting and moving and flowing and changing, coming into being and passing away, coming and going, arising and passing. And this was the core aspect of this right view, perspective, to really tune into the constant change. And the reason for seeing this constant change is that to really see it and perceive it, how things are constantly shifting, there's something about that insight, that perspective, that makes it difficult to cling, to grasp. And it's very hard for many of us to learn to really, first of all, to discover that we're clinging and how deeply it's kind of in the core of our operating system. Clinging to self, clinging to opinions, clinging to stories, clinging to desires, aversions, clinging to suffering, all kinds of things. And to really see it, and then also then, even to see it, it's hard then to imagine, how do I release myself from it? How do I not be contracted by the kind of clinging, the grasping attachment that we have? And so, but there's something about sitting very, very still and quiet, in a concentrated mode, and seeing the birth and death of the world over and over again, moment by moment, that's incomparably helpful for settling back and letting go, not holding on, letting just kind of be part of the stream, part of the flow. So that perspective of impermanence. The Noble Eightfold Path, the second factor of the eight, is usually called right intention, right attitude. And this is to live a life where one no longer has intentions or reflections or thoughts, attitudes, of sensual attachments to sensual pleasures, sensual cravings, no longer is caught up in having aversion towards people in other places, and no longer is caught up in having a hostility to the world. Instead, one is interested in an attitude of simplification or letting go or renunciation, an attitude of kindness, and an attitude of compassion. This new life the Buddha discovered was a life of simplicity, a life of kindness, and a life of compassion. The next three factors of the Eightfold Path have to do with ethics, kind of inner integrity, ethical integrity. A person has right action. To have this new life that the Buddha discovered is to not be involved in killing anything, not to be involved in taking what is not given, and not be involved in sexual misconduct. To do this really thoroughly is something the world is still discovering how to do, unfortunately. You think 2,500 years, you know, we got the message 2,500 years ago, not only from the Buddha, from other people, but somehow not everyone gets the message. But there are some people who discover how to live this way. And so the Buddha's enlightenment brought him into this new world, new way of living. No killing, no stealing, and no sexual misconduct. In his case, it was to be celibate. The next factor of the Eightfold Path is right speech, and this is to have truthful speech, to live a life where your speech is truthful, where your speech does not divide people. There's no divisive talk. And your speech is not harsh. And then there's no frivolous speaking. So that's a new way of living they discovered. And then also fifth factor is right livelihood. So how we live our lives, how we sustain our lives, how we support our life, is somehow one that doesn't cause harm for the world, for other people, for other animals. So to live a life that's harmless. And then the last factors of the Eightfold Path, the sixth, seventh, and eighth, have more to do with inner cultivation of the mind. And this has to do with being able to, right effort, has to do with being able to track and see what's going on in our mind and make choices to let go of unskillful, unwholesome thoughts, ideas, desires, but to pick up and be involved in skillful ones or wholesome thoughts and maintain them. So it's kind of being able to make a distinction, to see clearly the kind of movements of the mind which are not healthy and those which are healthy, and be able to choose the healthy ones, to live from that place. And then there's right mindfulness. And so this is, now you're attentive. This new way of living was a way of living where we're attentive to what's happening, present for our life as we're living it. And then right concentration. I'd like to think of it as a right unification. Concentration has a lot to do with being whole and not being so fragmented or spinning or agitated that all the different pieces of us come together to be in harmony or be connected. I think of it sometimes when we sit down to meditate and we've had a busy, frazzled day, like all the puzzle pieces of our life are separated and spinning out and they can't find each other. We sit down to meditate and all the puzzle pieces come back together and snap in and we become whole and settled again. So that this concentration is a lot to do with this coming in and being connected to ourselves. So to the Noble Eightfold Path, this life that the Buddha discovered, was a beautiful life, a wonderful life, a profound life, a life of kindness to the world. It doesn't cause harm in the world. Connected to ourselves in a deep way, and one that was happy. The Buddha talked about it as being a happy life, peaceful life. So that's the fourth of the Four Noble Truths, is this new life the Buddha discovered. The key for discovering this new life is the third noble truth, which is the cessation of suffering. But how that cessation comes about is described as the cessation of craving. Craving comes to an end. The kind of forces of craving is considered more fundamental than clinging. You crave first, and then you cling. And so this very deep movement of a compulsive desire, which the word in Pali, in Buddhist language, the literal word is not craving, it's a thirst. And kind of a biological, you know, if you're really, you know, thirsty, and you have this thirst for water, this compulsion, this, you know, or thirst for power, thirst for different things, we say. it's kind of this almost compulsive desire that, you know, get out of a drivenness that's there. And some of our clingings, some of the things we're attached to, some of our desires, have this quality of being compulsive or driven in such a way that we're not in control. They have us, grabbed us by the nose and pulling us around, or grabbed us by the throat, or kind of just propelled through us. And occasionally people will know better than some of the desires they have, but know better than not to act on them. But sometimes people act on them anyway, even though they know they shouldn't be doing it. And so it's the cessation of this craving. So that's the third noble truth. With the cessation of that craving, there's something about the freeing of this compulsivity, the freeing of the heart, the settling in that happens then, that naturally leads to living a different way. Because many of the ways that we live that are unhealthy or unwholesome or, are many ways of living, many people are based on attachment, clinging, craving. If the craving falls away, how would you live? Probably you'd live much more peacefully. If you live more peacefully, how would you live? Probably you live much more ethically. So with the craving, a whole new inner sense of being could arise for a person. And that deep new sense of inner way of being then becomes the guide for how to live the Noble Eightfold Path, which is described by the Eightfold Path or represented by it. So then the second noble truth is the noble truth of the arising of suffering, which is craving. That the craving itself is the genesis, craving itself is a form of suffering, craving itself is kind of embedded in all our suffering. The arising of craving is all different forms, all the different things we can crave for, that's the arising of suffering. Without craving, there would be no suffering. Some people hear this and they protest. But you have to kind of go along with how the Buddhists are defining this. What the Buddhists call suffering is the experience of pain, certain kind of experience of pain that we feel that comes with craving. So therefore, when craving ceases, that suffering ceases. There are other forms of pain that people experience. Like there can be grief, a sense of loss, someone dies and we feel sad or feel grief and mourning. You know, we don't go skipping down the streets, you know, whistling and singing songs and, after someone's died, you know, it has an effect on us. That wouldn't be called suffering in Buddhism unless there was some kind of craving or compulsivity or attachment connected to that mourning. The suffering that Buddhism is concerned with is a psychological sense of dis-ease, psychological sense of unsatisfactoriness, psychological sense of something is deeply off here, psychological suffering that's born out of this craving. So the second noble truth has a lot to do with beginning to appreciate or see clearly the role that craving has, or if the word craving doesn't mean much for you, clinging, or attachment, or compulsivity, or drivenness, or what are some other good words that are related?
Desire.
Hunger. Grasping. Is that as creative as we get with our wanting?
Dissatisfaction.
And they say that things like aversion, strong aversion and hostility and resistance can also be a kind of craving, yes? Yearning. Yearning can be so strong it can kind of eat a person up from the inside. So that's a second noble truth. The first noble truth is a noble truth of suffering. It doesn't say that life is pervasively a life of suffering. It says that in this life that we live, there is suffering. There's also happiness. There's also peace. But there's something very... If you want to become free of that suffering, you have to take it seriously. You can stop and look at it and really slow down so we can kind of get underneath the kind of the operating system underneath it, the craving that's underneath it. But we don't, you know, we're not, it isn't like we're studying Buddhism to suffer better. So it isn't like you stop and pay attention to your sufferings because, you know, we really want to, you know, do it well. But we stop to pay attention to suffering so we can somehow end it, somehow overcome it, somehow dissolve it or untie it. And so I kind of like to think that there's a very strong, something very wise and very mature about what the Four Noble Truths are asking us to do. And that is not to deflect, not to deny, not to avoid the places in our life where we feel dis-ease, where we feel uncomfortable, where we feel distressed or stressed, or where we feel there's suffering, where we feel something's wrong, something's off in some kind of way. Don't distract ourselves. But to stop and take a deep look at this, be with it. And one of the values of meditation, certainly, as we all know, I think at least popular literature these days emphasize how meditation helps us to relax and have less stress and be more efficient at work, and it's good for your nervous system and all kinds of, you know, wonderful benefits we read. It's very seldom in the popular literature they say that meditation helps you to just sit in the middle of your gunk. It helps you to sit right in the middle of your difficulty. But that's a very mature thing to do. To stop running and say, well, here I'm going to sit and I'm going to face this. I'm going to look at this and really wake up with it and be with it. Get to the heart of it, the heart of the matter. And if you can do that, and this kind of the training of Buddhism is to be able to sit really well, which means to sit really still. Still means to sit and not be agitated by what's going on, not be reactive to what's happening, not be for and against what's happening, not be adding stories and fears and desires on top of what's going on, but rather to settle deeper and deeper, to quiet in the middle of it. It's kind of like sit right in the middle. It's kind of like eventually becomes the, they say, I've never been there, but they say the eye of the hurricane is calm. So you sit in the, you know, the calm center of your hurricane of your life, which is a great place to sit. And then you sit and you see that everything is swirling. Everything is arising and passing, coming and going. And to be able to sit still, learn to sit still with confidence. Learn to sit still with tremendous faith, a sense of goodness, a sense of wholeness, a sense of being connected, all the puzzle pieces have come together inside of ourselves, and to sit really still and in that confident place and to be able to see the coming and goings of our life, the coming and go of every thought, every perception, the sensations we have, the feelings that come and go, is a way of beginning to slowly kind of the grip that the heart has or the mind has and our clinging begins to loosen in the flow and the change, the coming and going. Because in order to really cling well, there has to be the illusion that there's something solid there that we can hold on to. But when there's nothing solid there to hold on to, and we just see that all these things are coming and going, at first, sometimes it can be a little bit frightening, but with time, we realize this is where safety is found. Safety is found in this calm place where we can see the comings and going, but we are not the comings and goings. We're not troubled by the comings and goings. There's freedom in the midst of the comings and goings. And to to sit in the middle of this world of ours, find the calm, still place, and to watch the comings and goings, it's kind of the key, it is the key kind of to what the Buddha was teaching. And if you can do that, and then slowly over time begin to let go the clinging, the cravings, the graspings, then you become something different. And what the Buddha said is you become the Eightfold Path. Isn't that kind of nice? Maybe there's all kinds of former identities that you have which won't seem as integral or as close in or as core as the values or the lifestyle that is represented by this thing called the Eightfold Path. And somehow that's who we are. The stream of the path. So the Four Noble Truths, one of the most important teachings of Buddhism. There's a variety of different interpretations of it. It's a wonderfully rich kind of set of teachings that lends itself to looking at our lives in different ways. And I offer it to you here for this first day of the year. And perhaps you can think about it through the year, or use it as a reference point for the year, or explore it and study it, hear what different teachers have to say about it, read what different books have to say about it. Because the point is not to memorize other people's ideas of the Eightfold Path, other people's ideas of the Four Noble Truths. The idea is to discover them, what they are for you. And it's a wonderful thing to make them your own. When they've made them your own, is they free you. And you find a freedom, a confidence, a joy that is portable and you can take with you in any circumstance at all. And that confidence can come with you into all the joys and sorrows of this life. So the Buddha's Four Noble Truths and the Eightfold Path. So we have about 10 minutes. If any of you would like to ask a question or make a comment or offer a testimonial about this, if we can have the mic over here.
So, Gil, I've listened to a number of versions of the Four Noble Truths that you've given. There's one version where you talk about there's ease, there's a way to lose ease, you regain ease, and the different ways by which you regain the ease. And for some people, they relate more to suffering. It's just the way they are. And I'm one such person. Because I inherently feel that pain is gain, even though I know it's not true. And there are some people who relate better to ease, and you've told that many times. There's nothing wrong. That's how people are built. But the Buddha chose suffering to address this. And for me, when I first listened to this, it was just profound. It held me. Is it because the Buddha knew that humans have a negativity bias? Because in psychoanalysis and in neuroscience, it's well known that the way we evolved is by negativity bias. We tend to all the our forefathers who are very chilled out, Zen, and all that, they all perished. Those who are very careful, they evolved. So did the Buddha know that? Is that why he used suffering to depict the Four Noble Truths?
So before I answer your question, the way that you've asked it, I would like to challenge you a little bit to suggest that maybe ease is a more important part of your life than you've realized. You have got a little blinders on. And so maybe if you took the blinders off from suffering, you would actually see that in you already is more ease than you've accounted for. So now to answer your question. What I've suspected about how the answer to your question is that when you have a goal which is stated in the positive, so ease is a positive goal, it's too easy to get attached to it. And it's too easy to make it something that you try to talk yourself into or imagine is there or get attached to in some various ways. But when the goal is stated in the negative, then people are less likely to get attached, and they go, "This is it. Now I know what it is," and go around holding it. And freedom from suffering is a negative statement. And so it's the absence of something without positing the presence of anything. Because it's possible with the absence of suffering, there's many options for what's going to be present, not just one. Occasionally it might be ease, but there might be other times when it's compassion. Other times where, if our wonderful friend nearby, the San Andreas Fault, if it suddenly goes one of these days when we're around here and we don't perish in it, I hope that all of us get to work and try to pull people out of the rubble and do what needs to be done. And I don't know if ease is the right word for how we're going to be working at that time. So I'm supposed to be ease, I'm a good Buddhist, I'm going to take people out with a lot of ease. that's weird. but I'll try to dig it out without suffering, but I'm going to work hard. Anyway, so I think there's actually to have the religious goal, the goal in Buddhism to be an absence of something, gives us our lives in a much richer way and gives us actually more freedom than if we make it a positive thing that we're trying to attain. Is that okay? One more. Trudy.
Thank you. When experiencing grief, I got the impression that it can be without craving. It can be suffering without craving. Grief without clinging. Without clinging. And
that's what Charlie Brown has.
Well, I don't know Charlie Brown's secret.
Stay young.
I think it's late for that. But how to tease that out, how to separate it out, to be willing to suffer the grief and not muck it up with craving.
I think that's great. That's the idea.
Oh, yeah.
Don't be afraid of grief. No. We shouldn't be afraid of our emotions and what goes on in our life. The Buddha said, one of the interesting things the Buddha said, he said about his teaching, he said, "My teachings are for people who feel. My teachings are for people who feel. I think he meant something a little different than what we think here in English when we say feel, but that is okay. It's close enough. And so, so to feel our lives, if there's grief, to feel it, if there's sadness, to feel it. And then when we're practicing mindfulness, the idea is to feel it, but to be mindful, be attentive to what's going on, to see if we can start noticing what's extra. What's a burden? Is there clinging? Is there resistance? Is there judgments? Is there reactivity to it that can be considered extra? And slowly we can learn to simplify in a certain kind of way, purify our emotional life. And so grief at some point it can be pure grief without all this extra stuff that we add on top of it. And it can be, it's, I don't know if it's the right way of saying it. Probably there's a better way of saying it. But, there can be a feeling of profound rightness in feeling certain kind of grief. Of course, this feels right in some ways. It's painful, it's sad, but it's not like I'm... you're not justifying it exactly, or you're not glorifying it, but it's real. I'm here in a real, connected way, and I'm not fighting it or resisting it or swallowed up in it. I'm just going to simply here with it. But I think, if I may say, I think that you've grieved enough. Okay. So, thank you all, and I hope that the Four Noble Truths can be a guide for you.